minority groups are very fearful because of the Islamist background that the current government comes out of, and because there's been some horrific sectarian massacres on the coast in March targeting the Alawi population, and then later on in the summer in the south of Syria in Sweida targeting the Druze population. I just want to focus a little bit on what happened in the coast in March, because it actually didn't start out as sectarian slaughter. What it started out as was an uprising by Falul, or remnants of the former regime, who are against the transitional government and trying to agitate against it. Security forces went in to quell that uprising, and things got very out of control, and it did turn into kind of widespread sectarian slaughter. But I think some of the initial killings that were reported as sectarian attacks, they actually weren't. It was the case, for example, of Shuja al-Ali, who in May 2012 was responsible for the Hula massacre of more than 100 people. And he was really agitating, following the liberation, agitating, stoking sectarian tensions and calling for an uprising against the government. And when he was killed by security forces, his body was dragged through the streets of Hula, and many media reported this as a sectarian attack, but actually it was a revenge killing. And this really links into the issue of transitional justice, because, you know, one of the main problems with the new government is that it hasn't moved on the issue of transitional justice. And that's really a key thing for Syrians. They want to see the old regime, and not only the old regime, but all those responsible for war crimes brought to justice. And until that's really moving forward, we are going to see these kind of revenge killings. But undoubtedly, it got out of control. Many civilians were killed. Many women and children were killed. The vast majority of killings of civilians were by the Syrian National Army militia, which is like Turkish maligned militia from the north. But it was clear also that some forces who were clearly part of the general security or part of HTS also carried out massacres. On the other hand, though, other elements of the general security and HTS did go to villages to try to protect the villagers from attack. So it's unclear like how much this was directed by the central government or how much it got out of control. What is clear is that the government said that it would set up an investigation into what happened. That investigation was never made public and was really criticised for not being transparent. But in recent days, something positive has happened in that there is now a trial being held which includes both Falul remnants of the regime, but also members of militia allied to the transitional government to judge their crimes and the killing of civilians in the coastal region. So that's really positive. It's the first time in Syria's history that, you know, there's been a trial in which the authorities are implicated and being held to account. But to go back to the original question, you know, I think one of the main issues is not just about HTS ideology, but it's about the sectarian breakdown of Syrian society as a whole. You know, for the past decade, the people who suffered the most under the Assad regime undoubtedly were the Sunni Muslim majority. They're the ones who faced the barrel bomb attacks on their communities, the chemical attacks, mass arrests and torture, being driven from their homes and forced into exile. And they really have this sense of Sunni victimhood, which is now causing this revival of Sunni identity. And this is very problematic, because whilst the Sunni majority feels that they've been victimised, also the minorities feel that they've been victimised and have legitimate grievances. So what we're seeing is this sectarian engineering, which was specifically engineered by the Assad regime to produce societal breakdown, is now being carried over, and we're seeing that play out. And, you know, unless Syrians can come together and put their identity politics aside and start working together as Syrian citizens to try and build a secure and safe future, then we're just going to have constant instability going forward and constant conflict going forward.
I guess kind of sticking to the concept of transitional justice that you brought up, I wonder if whether in the diasporic communities or with the folks that are on the ground in Syria that you've been speaking with or hearing from, if there are any sort of like models, methods or approaches that you have found interesting that you'd want to share with the audience towards the idea of transitional justice. Maybe if you could like kind of define the term. When I hear it, it kind of makes me think of attempts at, as faulty as they may have been in circumstances like Ireland or South Africa, truth and reconciliation processes that have often been facilitated by outside NGO or like UN or third party agencies. But yeah, I wonder if you could go a little bit deeper, if you can, into the transitional justice idea.
Yeah, I mean, Syrians have been looking at different models over the past decade, those that are focusing on transitional justice and trying to take examples and inspiration from elsewhere. You mentioned South Africa. Also, Bosnia is a very pertinent example for us because of the sectarian breakdowns and the religious divides in the society there. At the moment, there's a big call from Syrian civil society on the international community to really give support to justice processes inside Syria. And I think that's the main focus, that they want these trials to be held inside Syria with support from the international community, support and expertise from the international community. The transitional government has been very slow to move on this. And
descobri somente agora, sem você não sei viver. Depois que você foi embora, eu fiquei triste a sofrer. Não suporto esta saudade, lembro-me a todo momento dos beijos que se acabaram. É tão grande o sofrimento, por isso eu digo a todo instante, volte depressa, passo de gigante. Por isso eu digo a todo instante, volte depressa, passo de gigante. Meu amor, eu sem você não sei viver. Descobri somente agora, sem você não sei viver. Depois que você foi embora, é, eu fiquei triste a sofrer. Não suporto esta saudade, lembro-me a todo momento dos beijos que se acabaram. É tão grande o sofrimento, por isso eu digo a todo instante, volte depressa, passo de gigante. Por isso eu digo a todo instante, volte depressa, passo de gigante. Meu amor, eu sem você não sei viver. Eu digo a todo instante, volte depressa, passo de gigante. Por isso eu digo a todo instante, volte depressa, passo de gigante. Por isso eu digo a todo instante, volte depressa, passo de descobri somente agora, sem você não sei viver. Depois que você foi embora, eu fiquei triste a sofrer. Não suporto esta saudade, lembro-me a todo momento dos beijos que se acabaram. tão grande o sofrimento. Por isso eu digo a todo instante, volte depressa, passo de gigante. Por isso eu digo a todo instante, volte depressa, passo de gigante. Meu amor, eu sem você não sei viver. Descobri somente agora, sem você não sei viver. Depois que você foi embora, é, eu fiquei triste a sofrer. Não suporto esta saudade, lembro-me a todo momento dos beijos que se acabaram. É tão grande o sofrimento, por isso eu digo a todo instante, volte depressa, passo de gigante. Por isso eu digo a todo instante, volte depressa, passo de gigante. Meu amor, eu sem você não sei viver. Eu digo a todo instante, volte depressa, passo de gigante. Por isso eu digo a todo instante, volte depressa, passo de gigante. Por isso eu digo a todo instante, volte depressa, passo de gigante.
Suno, aur gaur se suno. Are pehle taaliyan to bajao. चाहता हूं कि दुनिया में खुश रहना हो तो मानो मेरी बात। आओ ट्वीट करें का फुटा मौसम ले, आओ ट्वीट करें जिंदगी है यही। आओ ट्वीट करें का फुटा मौसम ले, आओ ट्वीट करें जिंदगी है यही। ना जुटी है जिंदगानी की ओ मेरी जान, चम चम अचम हाए हा हा। ट्विस्ट करे मौसम ने, आओ ट्विस्ट करे जिंदगी है यही। आओ ट्विस्ट करे मौसम ने, आओ ट्विस्ट करे जिंदगी है यही।
Adeus, vou embora, meu bem. chorar não ajuda ninguém. Enxuga teu pranto de dor, que a seca mal começou. Enxuga teus olhos, Maria, pulando meu coração. Eu voltarei qualquer dia, é só chover no sertão. Lá longe as horas da volta, eu conto na minha mão. Adeus, vou embora, meu bem. Chorar não ajuda ninguém. Enxuga teu pranto de dor, que a seca mal começou. Adeus, vou embora, meu bem. Chorar não ajuda ninguém. Enxuga teu pranto de dor, que a seca mal começou. Enxuga teus olhos, Maria, pulando meu coração. Eu voltarei qualquer dia, é só chover no sertão.
Chorar não ajuda ninguém. Enxuga esse pranto de dor. Kau sudah pergi, nun jauh membawa diri. Hati biru ku derita, di manamu oh adinda. Di mana janjimu dahulu, janji sumpah setia. Kita akan hidup bersama untuk selama-lamanya. Kala saja pujaanku, aku tetap merindu. Di mana kau sudah pergi, mungkinkah bertemu lagi. Air mataku mengalir, hatiku bertambah sedih. Walaupun di mana kau berada, namun kasih tak bernyala. Paduan jiwa tak tercipta, membara di dalam dada. Kala juritaku, aku tetap merindu. Di mana janjimu dahulu, janji sumpah setia. Kita kan hidup bersama untuk selama-lamanya. Kalah saja pujaanku, aku tetap merindu. Di mana kau sudah pergi, mungkinkah bertemu lagi. Air mataku mengalir, hatiku bertambah sedih. Walaupun di mana kau berada, namun kasih tak bernyala. Paduan jiwa tak tercipta, membara di dalam dada. Kala juritaku, aku tetap merindu.
Sem lenço, sem tormento, no sol de quase dezembro. O sol se reparte em crimes, espaçonaves guerrilhas, em cardinales punidas. Eu vou em caras de presidentes, em grandes beijos de amor, em dentes, pernas, bandeiras, pomba e Brigitte Bardot. O sol nas bancas de revista me enche de alegria e preguiça. Quem lê tanta notícia? Eu como entre fotos e nomes, os olhos cheios de luz, o peito cheio de amores. Vamos, eu vou, por que não? Por que não? Ela pensa em casamento e eu nunca mais fui à escola, sem lenço, sem documento. Eu vou. Eu tomo uma Coca-Cola, ela pensa em casamento e uma canção de consola. Eu vou por entre fotos e nomes, sem livros e sem fuzil, sem fome, sem telefone, no coração do Brasil. Ela nem sabe, até pensei em cantar na televisão. O sol é tão bonito. Eu vou sem lenço, sem documento, nada no bolso ou nas mãos. Eu quero seguir no vento. Amor, eu vou. Por que não? 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 Por que não?
Butterfly in the sky, I can go twice as high. Take a look, it's in a book, a reading rainbow. I can go anywhere, friends to know and ways to grow, a reading rainbow.
It's Vale. I'm here with Larkspur.
Hi.
We are recording just a little discussion for you all. It's December 11th, and just wanted to, before we get deeper in anything, just shout out a huge RIP to Jorge Esquivel. El Yorch passed away on Tuesday, December 9th. Passed away after being denied medical care from his jailers in Mexico. RIP, Yorch. We are saddened by your loss and the inhumane treatment that led to it. We're talking today about... So, there were a couple, like, kind of connected, or not necessarily connected, but, like, thematic things that I think I saw posted on A News this week. One was the Kingston, New York Anarchist Cafe, the Blackbird Info Shop up in the Hudson Valley. Closed its doors to the public, which is a bummer. It lasted for about 3 years. I've never been. But it seems, I mean, that area of the country is beautiful, kind of ritzy, a little wealthy, but for there to be like a little like anarchist coffee shop sort of thing seemed like a nice little, you know, project for people to work on up there. I mean, and it's not like super ritzy. There's plenty of working class stuff. I just know, you know, some of that Hudson Valley zone is like pretty, unless you're talking like Hudson, Poughkeepsie and stuff, like can be a little glitzy up there. You can run into what's her name, Gabby Hoffman from Girls. But yeah, it was like looking at that, and then also this piece in Organized magazine about this collective anarchist collective in, did I say they're in Tokyo, I believe? Yep, in Tokyo, the Nam Nam Space, which is a queer community art space run on anarchist principles. I guess, and like the principles that unify it, even though that they're not like an explicitly like kind of anarchist, you know, I guess the kind of like thought that I had connecting that is like the ideas of like anarchist infrastructure and like spaces and businesses and like the kind of not like business necessarily tied to like anarchists banding together to make money as like participants or actors within capital or capitalism and stuff as like a kind of anarchist intervention within it. But like looking at like ways to do like self-sustaining or infrastructural projects using some amount of like commerce as a basis for building a greater infrastructure for an anarchist community and what that can look like, and I guess maybe why it always seems to go the way it does or look the way it does or, you know, stuff like that. And I guess as far as bona fides, I mean, I've hung around and worked on InfoShop projects for very directly for at least the last, what, like four years or so, and like was party to the trials and tribulations of them in another city prior. And I know, Larkspur, you also work on the same project as I do.
We're in an ice cream shop together. It's a... Yes.
The info shop that we work through. We have, yeah, we have a bunch of those big Hershey's drums. And we just scoop moose tracks and...
No, Emma Goldman and Alexander Berkman co-owned or co-ran an ice cream shop in Worcester, Massachusetts, which is, I think, is still my favorite potential, like, info shop / anarchist idea.
That is true. Yeah, there's, like, I mean, I don't know what it was, the idea of, like, owning, like, these kind of, like, dairy businesses. I guess that's that. Well, I guess it's also, too, that, like, dairy and creamery collectives and stuff were a little more distributed or whatever, horizontally. They weren't, you know, like, a family with a decent amount of land could reasonably be assumed to maybe have, like, a dairy cow or something.
Maybe, but, that's...
I mean, they were pretty, like, urban people, though. They weren't, like, really... They just wanted to have a fucking ice cream shop, I guess. But, which is cool.
But yeah. Oh, it looks like it's now a very, like, this looks like one of, it looks like one of those very soulless things that, like, wine moms go to.
Like a paint draw.
It says tapas and wine, and it's called Bocado now, and it has that, like, font that you just see on the sort of place that's, I don't know how to describe it, but it's the font of the trashy middle class. This is wannabe fancy.
Is it like
very sad?
Like the signs you see at like Home Goods that say like gather.
Yes, exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Oh well.
Bocado. Yeah. I don't know. So, yeah, one thing. So, like in the past too, I have like worked for businesses that describe themselves as, I guess, anarchist, but, I mean, they weren't. Like, they just objectively weren't, but there is, you know, Ari Weinzig, the Zingerman's guy? You know about Zingerman's, though, correct? Because
yes, I do.
You spent some time in Michigan. I never worked for Zingerman's personally, but I worked for a business that was very invested in Ari Weinzig's, or Weinzig, I forget his, how to pronounce his last name, and Ari Weinzig's like kind of like anarchist business sort of ideas, and like he has like spun up Zingerman's from like, I don't know that Zingerman's are like technically a cooperative. I don't think they are. I think they do some profit sharing, like with employees, but I don't think it's like a worker owned thing at all. But like he sells basically like a side hustle of like management consultancy and like kind of. I wish Petra were here because Petra talks about the Zingerman's like management cult and stuff like that. But like the like markets these like business books for like progressive leadership and like horizontal-ish progressive leadership and management style stuff as like an anarchist. Or like a lapsed anarchist business model. And I mean, of course you don't buy the bullshit. Like, of course I didn't like, buy the bullshit of like my former coworker or my former employers who like had me in that system with them. But like, it is, it's bullshit.
It's bullshit. And I think there's like probably a slight hopscotch. Than a jump over to a certain other type of like business model where it's the, I don't know, blobby potential. I don't know how to describe it, like that blobby like liberal everything's like, oh, we profit share or we do this or that. It's right. Very, very stupid.
Yeah, it's like the kind of integrated like corporate structure with like very horizontal progressive accolades and stuff, and like, you know, a lot of talk about like restorative management practice and stuff like that, and like, talking about like, I don't know, it's weird. It's weird how much I think maybe some of the, I mean, a lot of the stuff that comes out of anarchism as like a relational or like collective organizing methodology, I think it's distributed into these kind of like either like NGO or nonprofit kind of spaces that are, you know, they are businesses. They function on some level of commerce, even though it's like rendering services for philanthropic stuff as revenue, like philanthropic donations or like grant funding or some amount of funding as their revenue stream that they use to then offer some kind of like product or care or service and stuff.
Community space.
I mean, a lot of things. Yeah. But yeah, it's weird. The like Ari Weinzig thing, the like Zingerman's thing is just like a very like 90s, like, you know, like global cafe kind of. You know, like global cafe kind of woodcut coffee cup and like grains and like a loaf of bread kind of wall art sort of pastiche that I think it comes a lot out of the kind of moment that, you know, the Zapatistas were kind of coming out of as like not out of like their moment, but like the kind of like weird moment of like subcultural popularity that like the Zapatistas kind of had within like how they became very fashionable and stuff. And I think that informed it on like some levels that I don't think the Zapatistas would be particularly thrilled with or like, you know, probably are like, yeah, that shit got fucking like co-opted pretty quick or, you know, got away from them. But like, yeah, I mean, I think like a lot of stuff gets brought out of anarchism as like a strategy for like anarchism is like basically what like a set of values that like posits remaking society through acts of creative destruction and stuff like the stuff that feels a little more at home and just like kind of evenly distributing like doing good works into the hands of like horizontal actors and giving those actors agency to like make empowered decisions kind of, I feel like, fits in line with some kind of corporate re-envisioning of like anarchist principles or whatever. I don't know. Anarchist businesses always look like a couple things, and they're usually like some form of like bookstore and coffee shop, which is a fairly obvious one, I would say. I mean, they work well as that kind of space. But yeah, they're tough. Like, I feel like the one that we participate in has been around for a very long time, partially because it functions entirely off like volunteer labor and like subsidizes and pays for itself largely through you know, selling books or like other merchandise sort of things, and not really through anything regarding like food service or space rental or stuff like that.
Yeah, I think the thing is that books and, I mean, well, as we both know, the profit margin on books isn't amazing, but and the profit margin on food service is okay-ish. I think these things tend to be the only other spaces that things that I would know as like explicit anarchist co-ops or are. Something that a friend of mine has mentioned and that I've seen in other cities where it's like a space that somebody like pays the rent on a building and tries to build maybe a little library within it and then begs for donations and tries to make it the people's XYZ community center or something like that.
Yeah.
And I
think there's a few of those around like this region of the country, I'd say. And they do it to a better extent than some others too. Like some do a much better job and some kind of flounder.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it would make me incredibly nervous to like, I personally really do like the bookstore model, but my biases are largely like, unlike doing anything with food, I think the margins are actually a lot better with like selling books because you don't have to worry about like
spoilage training, certification.
And yeah, a lot of overhead costs are like kind of constant costs that go towards maintaining of things. Like books will never really expire per se. And the markup that you get from most major distributors does allow you to make, to buy things, you know, at a wholesale rate that's like usually at least 40% discount. Like publishers, like the anarchist publishers, like PM and AK and Little Black Card all offer everything to most people around 50% off. And like, you know, that's pretty good. It's like for every one book you sell, you've basically subsidized two more books at the same price, and like that's a pretty sustainable way, like because then you can just like kind of meet your expenses and run it off the volunteer labor of like a fairly nebulous group of people who just basically need to be a body in the space and stuff. I feel like you're allowed to, I don't know. I feel like when you are selling books as an organ of like a propagandistic project, you don't have to like you can willingly kind of challenge people a little bit with like what you carry, or you can like curate your selection in such a way where like it doesn't have to be like when things market themselves so explicitly as community spaces, which it kind of seems like, you know, the Blackbird space that we were talking about does, and like some other spaces that I look up to a lot, but they ingrain themselves really, really heavily into the community. But as such, then they have to adopt all the kind of like most cutting edge progressive policies of the community and like invest deeply in the kind of comings and goings of the community and its like internal kind of strife and stuff like that in a way that I think makes navigating the kind of weird interpersonal type things of, or like intracommunal things within those kind of spaces, like so much harder than just like the, you know, you can just be a bookstore and sell the books, and like as long as you're not like seen as, you know, an actively antagonistically like evil project or something, you haven't like alienated, like you don't risk alienating your space from like its patrons, you know, it's like the people who are its patrons on like a financial sense.
Right. That's actually something that I have enjoyed about the bookstore project, is that because it functions as a business and isn't this sort of nebulous, as we said, tied to, you know, the activist community drama and whatever is the activist community buzzword of the day, we are part of our neighborhood and in a space where a lot of people who wouldn't necessarily, who aren't anarchists and aren't politically radical at all, are coming through and still hanging out, being in the space. I'm trying not to say space a bazillion times, but, you know, it is then a little bit of a neighborhood fixture in a way that I find actually more politically interesting, just in terms of interacting with people who don't share your stated values
right.
as much in that way. And I think, like, we've made the point plenty of times in these discussions that your average, like, liberal, gooey, we're a community space, we are for inclusion, and we want to see serve the needs of the community, is not something that's just close to anarchist values. So,
I mean, yeah, it's tough because I feel like, I mean, okay, so like, cards on the table too. In my like day job, I work in, you know, a lot of, like a public library type institution, and that is very much like adopting, you know, now that like libraries are no longer kind of like seen as these kind of, it's not a university library, so it's not really seen as this space of like heavily, like heavy, intense research. Libraries definitely are shifted very fully into meeting the needs as like kind of a community space and community hub stuff. And the sort of like, I feel like the bookstore project that I work on is sometimes a little bit of a respite from like having to be, I mean, I'm a decent person to everybody in like both spaces and stuff, but like, I wouldn't say that I like always feel like the bookstore project has to be the bleeding edge of like community health or harm reduction initiatives or things, as long as we're like meeting some amount of like need for people personally, as, you know, not like actively restricting things. I mean, there's like very easy small things you can do, and then there's things that it's like, you know, we're not going to be like a safe injection site sort of thing at the bookstore because we don't have anything close to the infrastructure that would require even like a larger institution than ours to really rack their brains to figure out how to have these kind of like, you know, resources present or like.
Well, one thing I've noticed is that when you hold a space like a bookstore or, I don't know, whatever else you would hold, there's a certain like type of person or organization that will seize upon that and try to expand it either by joining and pushing their own personal projects, or maybe it's like a different type of mutual aid or whatever type of group that'll decide, okay, well, there is a space that nominally shares our politics, and they call us, so they obviously are going to be able to do what we want to do, which is set up a safe injection site, or set up a community fridge, or set up XYZ project, offer free childcare. Nobody's tried to do that yet, but I think it could be.
It comes great. And goes from all of those things have come and gone from the project that we are both a part of. Most of them have never happened. So,
in part because there is obvious spatial and economic constraints that I think a successful project has to be aware of. There's certainly nothing wrong with trying to be a community fridge or a safe injection site or a daycare facility or God knows what else.
Daycare facility just makes me so nervous.
I think it's actually great. I really want a bunch of people who like Summit Hop to watch my hypothetical toddler. I think that would be so sick.
Yeah.
but, like, whatever it is, there's often this sense of it just, well, it should work, and we want these things to happen, so obviously this project that already exists can easily expand to take them on. And when you're part of a successful project, one of the things you realize is you kind of do have to keep your scope narrow, because you kind of can't do all that.
Yeah. I mean, I think keeping our, like, the scope of the project that we work on narrow is like kind of one of our saving graces. Like, I know that there was, like, there used to be a little bit more in line with, like, food and stuff that they offered, which I think was just kind of a barrier for a lot of people to, like, being able to perform consistent service, like, from shift to shift, like, because a lot of people were like, I'm not really interested in making soup or, like, roasting coffee beans